Define what you call trolling as it is on social media.
Sure. One of the issues with the use of vernacular, sound like a college professor, is when words become used in the popular context, they lose their kind of specific meaning, right?
Right.
So trolling does not mean taunting.
Right.
If I sit here and say, oh, Greg's a jerk, no one likes him, that is not trolling. These are facts.
Yeah.
Trolling
facts.
Is when you specifically act in a certain way that causes the party you're interacting with to turn into a performer for the sake of the audience. Michael Malice here. I've got a cheek full of gum. You've got a stomach full of cum. And together we're going to have a fun half hour here on Nightshade. There is a lot of drama going on around the world, and I'm going to address it as much as I can. First of all, so as not to be rude, I'm going to swallow my gum and make it disgusting. All right. Today, Nancy Pelosi and President Trump fired off dueling letters about the State of the Union address. Now, as some of you already know, the State of the Union is a constitutional requirement by the president. However, it is not the case that he needs to do this in person. Up until President Taft, you old dog, the State of the Union was delivered verbally and, in writing. Woodrow Wilson decided to address Congress in person, and that has been the status quo ante ever since. And Nancy Pelosi said that President Trump would not be welcome at the House to address the State of the Union. And he wrote her a lovely letter to this morning. Dear Madam Speaker, thank you for your letter of January 3rd, 2019, sent to me after the long shutdown began, capital S and shutdown for no reason, inviting me to address the nation, capital N, I guess he means the magazine, on January 29th as to the State of the Union. As you know, I had already accepted your kind invitation. However, I then received another letter from you dated January 16th, 2019, wherein you expressed concerns regarding security during the State of the Union address due to the shutdown. Again, capitalized for no reason. Even prior to asking, I was contacted by the Department of Homeland Security and the United States Secret Service to explain that there would be absolutely no problem regarding security with respect for the event. They have since confirmed this publicly. Accordingly, there are no security concerns regarding the State of the Union address, capital A. Therefore, I will be honoring your invitation and fulfilling my constitutional duty to deliver important information to the people and Congress of the United States of America regarding the state of our union. I look forward to seeing you on the evening of January 29th in the chamber of the House of Representatives. It would be so very sad for our country, capital C, if the State of the Union were not delivered on time, on schedule, and very importantly, on location, exclamation point. Sincerely, Donald J. Trump. So basically he said, yeah, that excuse you gave isn't true, so I'm coming anyway. Sorry about it. And she very quickly, it's not like she was in Afghanistan where they have slower email. She got her ass, what's the term? When you have to stay on the tarmac, there's a term for that. Anyway, she wrote back very quickly, Dear Mr. President, when I extended an invitation on January 3rd for you to deliver the State of the Union address, it was on a mutually agreed upon date, January 29th. At that time, there was no thought that the government would still be shut down. In my further correspondence of January 16th, I said we should work together to find a mutual agreeable date when government has reopened, and I hope we can still do that. I'm writing to inform you that the House of Representatives will not continue a concurrent resolution authorizing the President's State of the Union address in the House chamber until government has opened. Again, I look forward to welcoming you to the House on a mutually agreeable date for this address when government has been opened. Sincerely, Nancy Pelosi. This is very juvenile, very stupid, and very funny. And I don't know where this is going to go. This gives him the space to deliver it in the Senate chambers, on the border with Mexico, at some rally, via Twitter, from the White House, from the Oval Office. There's all sorts of places he could do it. Mount Rushmore. God, that'd be so funny. If he just had a podium built on Mount Rushmore, Like, and at it, like, and also, like, part of the podium was, like, his head, like, the size of the other, bigger. The head just got 10 feet bigger than the other four presidents on that monument. That would be so, so good. So I don't know what's going to happen here. Already, twice there have been votes, primarily from Republicans, to pay the people who are being furloughed currently, the non-essential workers. And at first, six Democrats broke ranks and voted with the Republicans to get these people their paychecks. This time, 10 Democrats broke with their party to vote with Republicans to get these people their paychecks, because this is a big argument. They're like, oh, the government's shut down. These people can't pay their mortgages, blah, blah, blah. And they're like, okay, here's a bill to pay them now. Well, we're not going to pay them. I mean, government shut down. So, I mean, that's just logic. So that's one of the things that is happening now. I can't read my handwriting. The last story tonight is going to be very, 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 very disturbing. And as you guys know, I've been keeping you guys abreast about – why did I say guys twice in one sentence? Abreast about what's been happening in Sweden. But Norway – has also had a major political issue just happened. I've heard the Prime Minister of Norway, Erna Solberg, speak. She speaks perfect English, and she's really, really eloquent. It's really kind of shocking when you see someone who's the leader of another country just talking not only in perfect English, but also using American concepts and just sounding completely like an American. It's very interesting to watch. So for the first time in 30 years, she had a minority government in Norway, and she reached a deal with the Christian Democrats last week to form a majority government. This is the exact opposite of neighboring Sweden, who has that minority social democrat government with barely, it's like 116 out of 375. So they actually have a majority now. So Europe, the problem with European politics is that for decades, understandably, the right was seen in many ways as synonymous with the fascists and the Nazis, because those are the big anti-communists historically. And this is something that they've been fighting. This is something they've had to shed. And it's increasingly happening. And now, at a certain point, you're a Nazi, you're a Nazi, you're a Nazi. You're not going to know what to do. And in fact, the funniest part is, as I discussed earlier this week, when the center party switched over to vote with the Social Democrats, her own Republican-esque colleagues called her a Quisling, called her a Nazi. So everyone's a Nazi now. So the move is going to strengthen her. She's been in power since 2013, was reelected in 2017. Norway is really interesting in terms of parliaments because it's, I think, the only country, one of very few, where you can't take down the government by a vote of no confidence. You have to have it every 4 years election. So Britain's very different. Sweden's very different. Germany, but in Norway, the government's in power for 4 years by hook or by crook. So she said, this is a historic day. Norway is getting its first non-socialist majority government since 1985. And she's led that conservative party since 2004. She said, we had tough negotiations, and the Christian Democrats were joining the current governing partners, which are the Liberal Party and the Progress Party. I just think it's very funny that the right wings in Norway, the two parties that are partners with her are the Progress Party, the Progressives, and the Liberals. Liberal, of course, in Europe, meaning more libertarian in the sense that we have here. The new majority did not come without a cost because the deal involved caving to demands by the Christian Democrats to amend Norway's abortion law. So the parties agreed to end so-called selective abortion, which means a woman's right to abort a fetus in a multi-fetal pregnancy, which can be done to limit the number of births. But she stopped short in their most controversial proposal, which sought to end the right to late-term abortions in cases where a fetus is diagnosed with Down syndrome or other genetic conditions. And she hopes that this majority government will provide more stability to her administration and help her get reelected in 2021, which it clearly will to some extent. Norway's often been ruled by minority government, which require the support in parliament of opposition parties to pass laws. And she said her new government would focus on the conservatives. A sustainable welfare society. Help combat climate change. Reduce taxes, okay. Strengthen family and children's rights and ensure social stronger security for all. Norway is Europe's top oil and gas producer, Western Europe's top oil and gas producer. They're going to keep drilling in the Arctic until 2021 and will uphold tax breaks on oil exploration. So One of the other comments that I think is important to make is that when you do have wealth, it's a lot easier to have a welfare state. Because when the money's pouring in from oil or from whatever the situation is, maybe your corporate stronghold, it's easy to kind of give everyone a little bit and then not have to worry about budgets and keep social stability and cohesion in that regard. Now, the biggest story today in international politics was what's going on in Venezuela. And for those of you who are following, the hashtag on Twitter is hashtag 23E, the letter E. Today being the 23rd. Yeah. So Juan, how do you pronounce his name? Guaido? G-U-A-I-D-O. I should have looked this up. Juan Guaido. Can we look this up? It'll be on his Wikipedia. Trump recognized Juan Guaido. Guido? It's not Guido. G-U-I-G-U-A. Guaido. Guaido.
Paisan.
Yeah, Paisan. Yeah. Yeah. Juan Guaido. He, as interim president of Venezuela, minutes after he declared himself the head of state. And this is being described as the U.S.'s most provocative move yet against the leftist regime of Nicolas Maduro. Basically, the guy said, I'm the president now. And President Trump goes, yeah, you're the president now. It's like, wait, what? What? And Maduro's like, I just got reelected. So Maduro responded by breaking diplomatic relationships with the U.S. and giving American diplomats 72 hours to leave the country. Now, get out. Guaido, is it Guaido? On the Wikipedia, right at the person's name, it'll have their pronunciation. Like, it's literally the first thing.
Yeah, it's Guaido.
Okay, thank you. Guaido, who's 35, just 35. Can we put up a picture of him, too? Let's find him. Is the president of their National Assembly, which Maduro doesn't even recognize. That'd be really funny if Trump is like, Nancy Pelosi, you're just some lady to me. I own this house. Get out. Venezuelans took to this. Oh, there. Okay. I don't like that look. He looks like he's an ad for a Men's Warehouse. Like, that's that tie and shirt combo with that, it's bad. And he looks like he wears Polo Sport. This is like one of those kids who was from Covington who got yelled at, like, just without the cap.
Worst Guaido ever.
Is he? Yeah, worst, yeah. I don't know about that. The situation's pretty bad. So he's president of the National Assembly, which Maduro doesn't recognize. Venezuelans took to the streets in the biggest protest since 2017 to back Guaido and increase pressure Maduro. And let me remind you guys, for this insane situation that's been going on in Venezuela, there have been many times when the government's goons opened fire on these protesters, like just mowed them down. I mean, there's no pretense of having free speech and right to assembly there. Trump said, the people of Venezuela have courageously spoken out against Maduro and his regime and demanded freedom and the rule of law. He said that because the National Assembly had declared Maduro illegitimate, that would be funny if Nancy Pelosi goes, oh, no, you're not the president anymore. Hillary Clinton's the president. That would be... that he said that the office of the presidency is therefore vacant. Now, shortly before his statement, Guaido said in a webcast, that's the other thing. This is like Arab Spring, that social media is getting people coordinated. It's getting people aware. Venezuela is a very big country. And if you have the government controlling the media, which they do completely, jailing journalists and not in a good way, it's social media that allows people to kind of keep track of one another and have this kind of coordination. So thank God for that. He said in a webcast from a protest in Caracas that he would assume the powers of the presidency and invoked a constitutional amendment that allows the head of the legislature to lead a caretaker government until new elections can be held. Since taking the helm of the legislature just 2 weeks ago, January 5th, it is so hot in here. It is so hot in here.
The booth is like twice as warm as the studio.
Is it really?
It's awful.
But you can open the door.
Yeah, but it's worse out. You believe me, you have it cooler.
It's worse in the hall?
Well, in the like the lobby.
I'm in a suit, and I've got a scuba suit underneath this. So I can go, deep diving, caving. What do they call that when the people die all the time?
Spelunking?
No, there's this thing. It's the most dangerous sport where they dive in caves and they have no idea how far it goes, and they just drown. Anyway, let's get back to Venezuela. God, I'm schwitzing here. Okay. He's aggressively pushed the military international community to recognize him as head of state after Trump's statement. Very quickly, this is leadership. Brazil, which is neighboring Brazil, Colombia, and Canada, all recognize Guaido as their Venezuela's legitimate leader, as is Peru and Chile. Mexico said no. But this is why this is important. Brazil has, as I've covered on this show with Bolsonaro, right, in Brazil, Brazil has had to deal with a lot of spillover from people from Venezuela spilling over the border, trying to flee the Venezuelan nightmare, and they don't speak Portuguese, which is the language of Brazil. However, I'm sure that the number of people in Brazil who speak Spanish is extremely high. They're basically like us. Guaido said, "I swear to formally assume the powers of the national executive as an interim president to achieve the end of the usurpation." He said this on a stage before thousands of people who had rallied around him. Today, the crowd cheered and sang the national anthem after he took the oath of office. Well, that is nice. It's nice to have some hope for the people of Venezuela who have really been suffering. I mean, the story, if you want to get really depressed, it's not North Korea level, but I mean, they're like a baby, like women who gave birth just laying in pools of blood in hospitals. I mean, it's just horrific. Horrific stuff. The U.S. has steadily expanded economic sanctions and denunciations of Maduro since Trump took office, all but urging the Venezuelans overturn their government. Their dollar bonds, which have gained 25% on average this year, rallied further on Wednesday. While most of Venezuela's bonds are in default, investors believe regime change could usher in plans to fix the economy and restructure the debt. Remember, regime change is bad when Bush does it. It's good when Trump does it. I have to give credit to my buddy Charlie Nash for making that joke on Twitter. The Trump administration has also been prepared to sanction crude oil exports from the country, but hasn't decided whether to take that step. And Maduro's reaction will help dictate whether the administration enacts the sanctions. He told reporters, President Trump told reporters, that all options are on the table. I guess that means nukes. For the U.S. to use against the Maduro regime, though he said he isn't currently considering military action. A senior official spoke to reporters, stressed the U.S. still has ample economic and diplomatic leverage to exert influence on the regime. The funny thing about their inflation, and I'm using the word funny incorrectly, they have something like 1,000,000% inflation. So basically now everyone in Venezuela is a millionaire, but like the value of a dollar, it became 1,000,000th of what it was earlier. It was, I mean, all wealth was wiped out. And everyone was equally broke. At a certain point, they had to change it so you can't even take out money from an ATM. There was a certain limit because everyone just wanted the currency in their hands instead of in the banks because the banks were being seized. So it's just madness. And again, with the brutality of the regime is a secondary issue, and the food being scarce. The official suggested Trump would impose additional sanctions if Maduro didn't immediately turn over control of Venezuela's finances to Guaido. And U.S. officials already warned some U.S. refiners earlier this month that the Trump administration was considering sanctions and advised them to seek out alternative sources of heavy crude. Oil companies have begged the Trump administration not take that step, warning that action could disadvantage Gulf and East Coast refiners who are designed to handle Venezuela's heavy crude and cause U.S. gasoline prices to spike. And Mike Pence, our vice president, said this week was the time for the Venezuelan people to make their voices heard. Nicolas Maduro is a dictator with no legitimate claim to power. He said this in a video posted Tuesday on social media a day ahead of these protests. So this is, I don't know. I mean, by the way, the Supreme Court, which are basically his puppets, have announced that it would depose Guaido and nullify the assembly's motion declaring Maduro's rule invalid. And the U.S. move to recognize Guaido risks a backlash, as Maduro is sure to warn that American Yankees are backing a coup against his government. But even pointing to the history of U.S. involvement in Latin America political affairs has worn thin for many Venezuelans and opponents of Maduro throughout the region. I mean, yeah, it's everything's America's fault. You know, that's why we're all starving and bloody. We encourage other Western Hemisphere governments to recognize President Guaido as the interim president of Venezuela, and we will work constructively with them in support of his efforts to restore constitutional legitimacy, said President Trump. The fact that he had the statement out for minutes after this happened means he knew it was coming, by the way, is my guess. Otherwise, he'd be like, what's going on? Let's get a lay of the land. He goes, we continue to hold the illegitimate Maduro regime directly responsible for any threats it may pose to the safety of the Venezuelan people. And Guaido has sought a transition government and called for new elections. He and his supporters say the latest term is illegitimate. About 60 countries concluded the election was fraudulent. That's a lot of countries. So we've got one last very, very disturbing story. One of the things that I find fascinating is when people have cognitive dissonance in the sense of they'll accept something in principle completely, and they will genuinely accept it and believe it. And then when you try to apply it in practice, they lose their minds. So like an example I had on Twitter the other day is everyone accepts, or most people accept pretty fairly, that children learn differently. That some children learn by doing, and some learn by reading, and some learn by being lectured, and some, you know, many, many ways. And then you're like, all right, let's not have public schools where everyone's sitting in the desk and getting lectured. Oh, what? My God, you're going to have riots. So that is one example. And here's another example. Everyone understands that Hollywood is full of perverted, and I'm using that word very specifically, degenerate people. Like for decades, the stereotype of the young girl who goes to Hollywood and becomes sexually preyed on by the producers and people who work there. This is not, no one doubts that this is based heavily in reality. And the question is, okay, why wouldn't this happen to young men who go to Hollywood and you have gay directors doing the same thing? And it's like, oh my God. Or they would agree with that maybe in theory, kinda. But as soon as you actually start naming names, it's like, it can't be this person. I watched his movies, I like him. I mean, it's hard to reconcile the principle with the actual person. So there was a major story today in the Atlantic about Bryan Singer. So he has been accused by four men of sexually assaulting them when they were underage. By the way, this is old news in a sense. I remember even Milo talked about going to, like, seeing, knowing about or going to parties at Bryan Singer's house about, you know, the kids being everywhere. These are the latest in a long list of claims brought against him over the years, ranging from inappropriate touching to flat out rape. So there's a difference between I'm sure nothing I say is going to be edifying in this context about this issue. The report was issued Wednesday by The Atlantic, and the outlet said it was based on 50 sources, including four men who would not identify themselves with fear of repercussions. The expose notes that the victims were left with psychological damage, substance abuse problems, depression, and PTSD. One of them, a kid by the name of Valdovinos, worked on the film App Pupil. And he said, after being dropped off by his father one morning, and trigger warning, this is fucked up stuff. After being dropped off by his father one morning, he was directed to the locker room. He's 13 at the time. 13. That's like middle school or freshman high school. He was directed to the locker room. Shooting's about to begin. He remembers that the locker room had been divided, a screen here and lights over there. A crew member gave him a towel and told him to disrobe completely and wrap the towel around his waist. He hadn't even had his first kiss. He's hanging out, he says. All of a sudden, Bryan Singer comes in, 13 years old. He goes, hey, how are you? Real cheerful. And he's like, hi. He goes, I can't remember his exact words, but he kind of just said, come back here. He kind of directs me, he kind of grabs me, and he takes me to the back area, which was kind of closed off. They're doing their stuff over there, and I was back here in the towel with no shirt and no clothes on, sitting in one of the locker room benches. Bryan says, Where'd it go? Oh, just hang out here. I'm going to be all day. Don't worry. So he leaves, and the kid waits for what seems like hours. Eventually, Singer comes back, makes small talk. How are you doing? Do you need anything? Why is he chatting with a 13-year-old to begin with? Like, already, this is fucked up. If you're chatting with a 13-year-old chick, it's fucked up.
If you're the director on a film, you're only talking to, like, the top crew people at all and the actors. Like,
right.
You should be talking, you know, you don't just see how people are doing randomly.
Right? I'm not mistaken on this.
Yeah. It's, like, okay. Hard to get to the director.
Right. That's the whole point. Like, and there's this air of, you know, you don't approach him unless he approaches you, like the queen.
Exactly.
Every time he had a chance, the kid says, three times, he would go back there. He was always touching my chest. If you're putting your hands on a 13-year-old boy, you are crossing a major that you don't know. It's nothing pat on the back or whatever. That is clearly crossing a line. Singer reached through the towel flaps, grabbed his genitals, and started masturbating him. The director also rubbed his front part on me, and he did it all with this smile, saying, "You're so good looking. I really want to work with you. I have a nice Ferrari. I'm going to take care of you." This is sick, sick stuff. And again, that there's so many of them. Why it's called sexual predation is that when you're 13 and something like this happens to you, you know what the fuck to do. And it's very easy to tell the parents, and the parents to be like, "Oh, this is Hollywood. He's just being friendly. Blah, blah, blah." Oh, just very disturbing. He says he was frozen. He was speechless. Three sources confirmed to The Atlantic that Singer did drive a Ferrari at the time. And they were able to verify his description of how the set was arranged and of certain people he says he met there. His father told The Atlantic he remembers dropping the kid off for filming and thinking that perhaps his son would become an actor. Singer's lawyer said he could find no record of him having been an extra and questioned why he was not able to produce a pay stub or other documentation. You're 13. Where's your documentation? Where's your pay stubs, 13-year-old? In a statement provided to Fox News, are you ready for this shit? Singer denounced this as a homophobic smear piece. It's homophobia. He said, "The last time I posted about this subject, Esquire was preparing to publish an article written by a homophobic journalist who has a bizarre obsession with me dating back to 1997. After careful fact-checking and in consideration of the lack of credible sources, Esquire chose not to publish this piece of vendetta journalism. That didn't stop this writer from selling it to The Atlantic." 50, they talked to 50 people. There's four guys accusing him. He goes, "It's sad that The Atlantic would stoop to this low standard of journalistic integrity. Again, I was forced to reiterate that this story rehashes claims from bogus lawsuits filed by a disreputable cast of individuals willing to lie for money or attention. And it is no surprise that with Bohemian Rhapsody, which he directed, being an award-winning hit, this homophobic smear piece has been conveniently timed to take advantage of its success." The thing why I believe stories like this is he didn't even say anything. If it was like two adults, that would be that crazy. He's not saying we made out, we had sex, he got me drunk. It's so boring almost in what he's accusing him of that rings so true. Because I think that, I mean, I've know people who've had things like this happen to them, and the matter of factness is part of the predation, because then the victim doesn't think that there's anything weird about it. It's just done very calmly. Hey, this is cool. Be cool. And it's a gaslighting. It's a form of gaslighting, because that poor kid is like trying to take the lead of an adult, let alone the director of the movie. And he doesn't know what to do except for go with it. And it's not like he's in pain. So obviously it can't be hurt. So one of the other accusers claimed that Singer fondled him on movie set when he was 13 in 1997. Another said when he was 17, Singer had sex with him at a party. While a third man said Singer had sex with him when he was 15, and a fourth said he had sex with Singer when he was 16 after meeting the director at a series of parties. All of the victims noted that Singer was aware of their ages at the time and was himself in his 30s. This is not the first time he's been accused of this kind of misconduct. In 2014, an aspiring model named Michael Egan filed a civil suit against him, saying that Singer forced him to have sex during parties in California and Hawaii. Singer denied the allegation. The lawsuit was dropped. More men started to come forward with allegations against him. This is really one of the good things about this, if you could say that, is this is going to encourage other victims to come forward. And at a certain point, they can't all be lying. I don't think they're lying. And again, none of these stories are particularly titillating. They're not crazy. It's not like, what was that girl's name who was accusing Brett Kavanaugh? "I kept going to these parties and getting gang raped, and he's standing around getting drunk." These are not that. I was at a party. I was 15, and we fucked. That's not a particularly interesting story. What it is particularly disturbing and egregious and when the ages are involved. And it's all right. So we've had a lot of this has been a dark episode. This has been a very, very dark episode. Hopefully tomorrow we are going to have a little bit more less rape stories, less bloody revolution stories, more petty drama in Washington. That's what I like. And that is what I endeavor to give you tomorrow on Thursday. Until then, I will wish you sleep with one eye open.
They don't have diabetes. You look really familiar.